Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and we've got my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn, with us today. Welcome back to the show, Mom.
Thank you.
It's been a little while since you've been with us.
That's right. That's right.
So
I'm glad to be back. This was an interesting book to get back on.
It was. And why don't you introduce our author today?
Okay, now our author is Nancy Slonim Erany, is that
Erany,
right?
Erany.
Yes, okay, yes. Now she is the author of Seven Secrets to the Perfect Personal Essay, Crafting the Story Only You Can Write. And, you know, this is, I never even imagined that this, that there were so many people that wrote these essays. Because, you know, when I was teaching school, an essay was maybe a part of an assignment or something for English. But, you know, these are so good. I was really impressed. I really was.
I'm glad.
And, okay, she is the founder of, is it Chillmark?
Yep.
Writing workshop on Martha's Vineyard, where she lives. And she has been a regular contributor to National Public Radio's All Things Considered, as well as a columnist for multiple newspapers. So, you're in for a treat, guys. All right.
Well, welcome to Writers' Voices, Nancy.
Thank you so much.
So, are you on the vineyard right now? Is that where you're calling us from?
I am. And I'm very envious that you have your mom to work with. Oh, that's just beautiful.
Yes, it is. And we've been doing this show together since 2006.
Oh, that's so great. I had a great mom, too. In fact, the very first validation I ever got in writing was we had to make our own cards, birthday cards, all cards. We weren't allowed to go to Hallmark and buy them. Now I think it was economical, but at the time I thought it was a creative thing. And I think I was 7, and I have a sister named Margie, but I have no brother. And I gave my mother this homemade card, maybe 6 or 7 years old, and it said, "Happy birthday to mom from Margie and Nancy and Tom and Tom." My mother looked at it, and she looked at me, and she said, "Oh, honey, this is wonderful, but who's Tom?" And I remember rolling my eyes heavenward and saying, "Oh, it rhymes with mom." Now, she had the opportunity to nip the little writer in the bud and say, "But you can't do that." Instead, she lit up as if I had written some brilliant treatise. And she said, "Oh, of course. Like, how stupid am I to not realize how brilliant you are?" And, you know, when you're little, and I think you probably have the same mother, when you're little and you get that kind of validation, it goes into every cell of your being. And I know
Absolutely. It
probably started my writing soul.
Yes.
Probably did. Yep.
That's fantastic. Now, I have a friend, my friend Margie, my business partner Margie, well, and her mother lived on Martha's Vineyard for, I don't know, 40, 50 years. So maybe you knew her.
Who is it?
You know, I can't remember because I always just know her as Margie's mom.
And, all right. Well, when you get her name, text it to me.
I will. She passed away a couple years ago, but and Margie still goes to the vineyard every year. You know.
I'll probably meet her tomorrow.
Yep.
in line at the bank.
That's right. So Nancy, what was your writing career like? Were you, how did you actually get involved in being a writer?
You know, I always wrote. It came very easily to me, so I never honored it as a gift. It's really interesting that things that come easily you think don't have value. So I wrote in high school. I wrote for the school newspaper. I wrote all the time. And then I started running. It was the first time I had ever done anything physical or disciplined. And I wrote a piece about it because I was so elated. It was the first time endorphins probably ever entered my physical body. And I was old. I mean, I was probably 30. And I wrote... I wrote a
Come piece. On. Not old. You cannot call that old. From our vantage point, 30 is not old.
But old to find out what discipline meant. Old to find out that you could push yourself and get up in the morning and make yourself do something hard. Yeah. That's what I meant. Not any other. And believe me, I know old. So I wrote a piece and I sent it to my local little town newspaper. But I also sent it to the big city paper. And my little town newspaper called me and said, we're putting it in. It's coming out Friday. And we're paying you $75. And I was ecstatic. And then the city newspaper called me and said, we've already put a drawing to it and it's coming out tomorrow. And I was like, oh, so I actually had submitted it to another paper. Well, I got, you know, they tore me a new one. They were so angry.
Oh.
But so I couldn't put it in the big paper. I had to honor the first people that I had sent it to. So I learned, you know, I learned something there, but I actually didn't stick to that because usually they keep the thing for months and months. But then something happened. I started taping and writing these short 2-minute essays because it's my forum. And I would send them to NPR. This is before NPR ever had any kind of commentaries. They were just a news show. And at that point in my
social life. So why did you send them to them?
I don't know. I have a feeling we all have like an inner guide that if you listen, you pay attention. Honestly, I have no idea why I did that. In the meantime, in my social life, we would go to parties and I would walk in to the kitchen and do 15 minutes of comedy and everybody would be laughing and I'd have all these great friends. And on the way home, I started to burst into tears and say to my husband, how do I go from being everybody's comic to professional? How can I turn this into something? I know I'm funny. I know I'm good at this, but I hate myself. I keep having this self-hatred thing of, why am I giving it away? How do you go from this, giving it away free, everybody loves me, to turning it into something? And, you know, I'm married to a phenomenal cheerleader. He said, but babe, everybody loves you and you're adorable. And I said, yeah, but I don't want to be adorable anymore. and then I actually wrote to all my friends and said, I'm breaking up with you temporarily. I have to change. I have to get deeper. I have to somehow figure out how to take myself seriously. And all my friends understood. They were fabulous. So I stopped going out to these parties and I started writing. And in the middle of all that, this is ages ago before the internet, I got an obscene phone call like every other woman that I knew. And the way the call went was the guy called me. I was cooking, the oil was bubbling, the dog was barking, the kids were running through the house. And I answered the phone, I said, hello, and he said something, and I couldn't hear him. I said, I'm sorry, can you repeat that? And he repeated it, and I said, you know, this is crazy. My house is crazy right now. Let me go take it in the den. So I put the phone down. Yeah, I took it in the den, all right. And I went into the den, and I picked up the phone. I said, kids, hang up the phone, and they did. And I said, now, hello, I'm so sorry. It's crazy here. And he said, can I, baby? Well, in the old days, when we got those phone calls, we would hang up immediately in terror. But I think I had invested so much time in this guy. I didn't hang up. I said, do you have any idea what this kind of phone call does to a person? And he said, I thought girls liked it. And I said, you know what? There might be some, but most people don't. And you probably are a good guy. You sound like a good person. Don't do this anymore. I'm shaking right now. You don't want to do this. This is violent, what you just did. And now I have a question. Do you know me? And he said, no. And I said, how did you get my name? And he said, I got it out of the phone book. And I said, well, thank you for telling me that. That was very kind because, you know, it's a little less terrifying. But I'm serious. I don't want you to do this anymore. And he said, okay. And then he said a word that everybody was saying in the early 70s. He said, later. And I was like, no later, no ever again. Oh, my God. But I hung up. I got to the dinner table. And I was so happy that that I had communicated with this guy and that I had been honest and nice and not ugly, and I didn't hang up, and I didn't, and I wasn't violent back, and that he heard, I knew he heard me. And I'm telling the family, even though the kids were 7 and 9 or pretty young, I don't think I quoted, but I probably did because I don't have a filter. So I probably did say what he said. Anyway, Josh, my 9-year-old, said, "This guy sounds really sick, Mom." And I said, "No, not sick. I think just lonely. I think he just doesn't know what to do with himself." The next night, the phone rang, and we're eating dinner. And in those days, remember the long cord? You're too young.
Oh, I am not too young. I am not too young.
And we didn't know about quality time with our children. That was the other thing. So, you know, I would talk on the phone during dinner to girlfriends. So I answered the phone, and it's him. And he goes, hey, how you doing? And I said, we're actually having dinner right now. He said, okay, I'll call you back. So I said, okay. And I hung up, and the family was like, see? The guy's totally messed up. I said, no, really, clearly lonely. So he did call me back. And I said, the first thing I said was, where do you work? And he said, I work at Goodrich Tire. And I said, do you like your job? He said, no, I hate my job. I'm thinking of quitting. And I said, well, don't quit until you find another job. Are you looking? He said, yeah, I'm thinking of going up to my uncle's chicken farm in Vermont. And I said, well, that sounds good. You'll be outdoors with nature and with a relative. Do you have a good relationship with your uncle? He said, nah. I said, then it's not a good idea. I'm not kidding. He started calling me. And those are the conversations that we would have. And when he would call, my kids would answer the phone and go, Mom, it's your obscene phone call guy. Unbelievable. So he really did start calling me about once every 3 days, and I talked to him. And I knew every time I told a girlfriend, they cracked up. And when I realized that this, I mean, I knew it was unusual, but when I realized it was something to write, so I wrote it. I hired a sound studio, I taped it, and I sent it to NPR, and they aired it that night. And
what?
They started doing commentaries. Yes. I got calls from all over the country. I just heard you on the radio. So I didn't tell you this part, but after when I started sending these written pieces to NPR, I got a postcard, single spaced with typos, from the program manager who said, I received all your pieces. They're really funny, but I can't use them. And this is the line that totally, I carried that postcard around. You sound like someone I'd love to meet at a party. This is after I had just said, I can't do this anymore. That line, you sound like someone I'd like to meet at a party, was ripped through my gut.
Oh.
And I said, now I have to become professional. So anyway, I started writing for NPR, and that opened every door. And, you know, then I got a column in McCall's, and then lots of things. It just was the credibility that I had needed. And what's really interesting is that the people in my workshop, and the reason you loved, Caroline, the essays in the book, people are brilliant. There are so many great writers who aren't getting the credibility and the validation and the contracts. So that's really why I wanted to do this book. I've been trying so hard to get these people out there. There are tons of way better writers than me that don't know how to get there. And I think a lot of it is, it's a Yiddish word, besheret. If it's meant to be, it gets there. And a lot of people, maybe it's not in your trip, your journey. It's not supposed to happen, but you're not supposed to ever give up if it's what you want.
So this is not your first book, though.
No, it's the third.
So you've the other books were, let's see if I got the titles here, Memoir as Medicine, The Healing Power of Writing Your Messy, Imperfect, Unruly, but Gorgeously Yours Life Story.
Yep.
And then Writing from the Heart, Tapping the Power of Your Inner Voice.
Yeah, that one was 1999.
Wow. So why such a big gap?
Well, after that one, my editor, and that was Hyperion Little Brown. So it was a major publisher. And she called me and she said, the book is doing great. let's write another one. And I said, but I haven't grown. I haven't changed. There's no anything new to write. And she said, well, just write the same thing, but, you know, differently. And I was appalled. And I realized that a lot of sequels, that's what it is about. You know, just do the same thing. Well, you know, you're on a roll. You've got some momentum.
Yeah.
And I wasn't much of a marketing person. And I kind of I wasn't happy with that. You know, write the same thing, but, you know, fool us. So I didn't for a long time. And then I had my son, Dan, got diabetes at 9 months old. Youngest diabetic in medical history.
Oh.
And then at 22, he got MS. So for the next several years, I was watching my boy deteriorate, and ultimately he died 12 years ago. But my husband and I were doing our time and our money and our energy and our love and our terror were occupied with taking care of our boy.
Sure.
Yeah. But since then, you know, he's my muse.
Oh.
Because so much of my material comes from, really, he gave me my priorities. I found out what was important in life. I mean, I kind of knew, but I wasn't living what was important. And once he got sick and I realized that going down to his house and taking care of him and watching the story that I was, you know, a lead player in, was way more important than getting invited to Carly Simon's brunch, which at the time I thought was, you know, the most important thing for me. I just got what was important. And he was my teacher. And you know what? I knew he was going to be my teacher. When he got diabetes, I didn't even know the phrase, but in my gut, I knew that I was going to learn, that I was going to grow from this experience. And I now am pretty sure they're called sacred contracts. Did you ever hear of Carolyn Mace, M-Y-S-S?
Yes.
Carolyn Mace. Yes. So she wrote a book called Sacred Contracts. And I, when I read it, or the chapter in Anatomy of the Spirit, that was her book, I was in the middle of reading it, and I read the chapter Sacred Contracts, and the chapter was about you make a contract with someone. Now, this is predicated on the fact that you believe that you live many times. I'm married to a scientist. This is not his trip. It's mine. But you make a contract. Your souls make a contract that you will come back each lifetime to be teachers for each other until you have learned what it is you need to learn. So the way she described it for me was, you're in your cloud with your angel. I'm in my cloud with Dan and our angel. And my angel says to me, so Nance, what do you want to learn in your next lifetime? And I said, I have been a control freak for so many lifetimes. I'm sick of it. I don't want to be a control freak anymore. So I'd like to learn how to let go, surrender. And then she turned to Dan and said, Dan, what do you want to learn in your next lifetime? And he said, I have been a victim in so many lifetimes. I don't want to be a victim anymore. And she goes, ooh, have I got a lifetime for you too? So one of you is going to be the mom. And one of you is going to be the kid. The kid's going to get a disease. And mom, guess what? You won't get it. It'll be too hard for you. So then he'll get another disease. And that's when you're going to get it. So the kid's going to have a harder time. You're both going to have a hard time. The kid's going to have a harder time. So who wants to be what? He said, I'll be the kid. And then our angel kicked us out of the cloud. And as you're tumbling to earth, she goes, oh, and you're not going to remember any of this. So, of course, I didn't remember any of it. But when I read that chapter, I started crying. And it just felt so right. It felt so familiar. And I said, okay, so this is what I'm doing with him. He is my teacher. And, you know, even though it wasn't easy, it wasn't the kind of difficult that was impossible. Like, how could this have happened to me? Instead, it was, we're doing this. And ever so often I'd say to him, Dan, we're doing great, right? And then he became this wise teacher and would go, we're doing great. So the sacred contract thing was major understanding. And so that's what we did in those years, is we took care of our boy.
Wow. You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Nancy Slonim Aronne, author of 7 Secrets to the Perfect Personal Essay. So what exactly is a personal essay?
It's your take. It's your perspective. It's your story. It's honest. It happened. It's not fiction. You're not making stuff up. And it can never be wrong because it's your experience. Now, somebody else is going to hear that story and they were part of it and go, that's not how it happened. But they have no right to say that's not how it happened because it's your take on it. It's how you felt. How you feel is the truth of how you feel. Facts are not part of it necessarily. This is how it felt to me at the time. The dress was red. Maybe it was purple. It's mostly about the emotional truth. And that's what you're looking for.
Mm. Now, you mentioned that the writers that come to your workshop, you wanted to get them out, and that's part of why you wrote the book. You wanted to be able to bring attention to their work. Where else today would if you want to write personal essays, I mean, I hate to use this term, but what's the market for them?
Not much. If you're famous, that's how you get them in. And that was one of the reasons I had trouble convincing this editor that I wanted to do this book, because he said essays don't sell. Mm. So, you know, and it's all about marketing now. I mean, maybe it always was. But I can't recommend how you do it out there. I am so not part of the publishing world, and I don't really know how. But the internet, you Google. And you can find, I bet you if you typed in where are personal essays published, who wants my essay? There must be tons of things.
I will say that I have noticed a huge increase in these newsletters that people are publishing, which are basically just personal essays.
Exactly.
Now, sometimes they're political or they're, you know, have another slant, but a lot of times they are personal essays. And on Substack and Medium are the two, and I think Patreon is the other platform.
Exactly.
And so I find myself reading multiple personal essays every day.
Yep. And they're good.
Of that. Yeah. Yeah. And I, two years ago, I wasn't doing that.
No, so. It's definitely mushroomed. My editor, actually, my assistant wrote to me this morning and said, how she puts my essays. I have a column in the Martha's Vineyard Times, and she sends it out to my list. And this morning she wrote and said, how about if we start a Substack? And I said, do whatever you want to do. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely.
So now I'm going to have a Substack.
And so let's talk about what makes the perfect personal essay.
I think vulnerability is the most important key, that I have to know that your broken heart is just like my broken heart. Your story is going to be different from mine, but I want to be able to relate to it. Your details are going to be different, but I also want to know that we have experienced what it feels like to be absolutely at the bottom and thinking, what am I doing here? How can I manage? And the beauty of the personal essay is you're kind of giving a map. This is how I got through it. This is what I did. So this is what happened to me. This is who I am. And I'm crawling out of the hole. And this is where I am now. So it's not like a journal entry. It's a complete, you know, this is what I went from here to here. So you are giving a bit of a map of you can make it. You can do this.
So, Caroline, do you have some questions?
Well, I do have a couple comments. The bio at the end of the book, where you give the biographies of the authors that you have published here in your book, that was very interesting to find out a little bit about them. And, you know, actually, you say most of the writers are regular people trying to make sense of their lives. And that's all of us, isn't it? We're all trying to make sense of our lives.
Exactly. Yep. And that's, you know, writing is a great way to find out where you're stuck, to find out how brilliant you are, all of the ways to see yourself in a kind of different way than you usually do. You're not in your head so much. You're on the page.
Oh, interesting. You talk about vulnerability as being the key, one of the key elements. But now, that doesn't mean you only can write about sad things.
No, you can write funny stuff, but I still have to know who's in there. I can't just have it be lightweight. There's got to be something that transformed you. The transformation is what we want. We want to know you were this way, you thought this thing, and then you got knocked in the head by something. Something broke you, and now you see it differently. And that's the map part. That's the part that says, you know what? We can change. We can learn stuff.
Absolutely. So are all the essays that you share in this book from people who attended your workshops?
All but three. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And the three, my editor wanted the book to mostly be about college essays. And I said, no. And I do have a lot of young people that take the workshop. I've had 15, 14-year-olds, and they're 27-year-olds, and they're 68-year-olds, and they're 82-year-olds. And there was a 91-year-old last time. but I didn't want it to be exclusive, so I did call two young friends of mine who were high school kids. And one of them was his essay. I said, will you write me an essay? And he said, well, I just wrote an essay for my college. And I said, okay, send it to me. And I read it, and it was gorgeous. And he did get into Harvard with this essay.
Oh, wow.
And he's going right now. So he was 17, and now he's 18 or 19. And then the young gal that wrote it when she was 16, and her piece is gorgeous. So there,
the one
two
about going into New York on the train.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Wasn't that beautiful? Oh, yeah. She's unbelievable. Yeah. And then there are one or two other ones, so maybe four that didn't take the workshop, but they all are going to. They all said, "I've always wanted to take it. I'm going to take it. I promise, I'm going to take it."
So you're still doing it. How often do you do this workshop?
I'm doing one next week at Propalo, but I suppose you air this so that it won't be like a next week, but
right,
February
right.
2nd. And then I'm doing one in May at Omega, and then one in June on the Vineyard, one in July on the Vineyard, one in August on the Vineyard, one in September on the Vineyard, and one in October on the Vineyard.
Wow.
The October one is very expensive because the workshops have gotten very large, 24 people. And people are fine, and they end up with the same really, really powerful experience. But a lot of people have written to me and said, I would pay more to have it be small.
Ah.
So the October one is small, and it costs more than I would be able to do. But and the other thing is I give scholarships all the time. So, you know, if someone calls me and says, I really want to come, it's very expensive to stay on the Vineyard. So everything about it's high priced.
Right.
So I like to be able to give it to people. And that way it kind of covers
how long are the workshops?
4 mornings. People come down on a Sunday night, and it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, 9 to 1. It used to be 9 to 12, and I could feel at 11:45, everybody, there were three more readers. And I'm looking at the clock going, oh, my God, I don't want to rush them. Why don't I just add the hour? And then I serve hot bread and jam, because after you've been sitting and listening and crying and laughing, and the bread is unbelievable. And then and it's also like a social thing. Everybody who's been listening to each other and really caring about each other, then they get to stand. And I watch groups and I watch them interact, and it's like watching my children fall in love with each other.
Oh, well, isn't it difficult to have that many people? I mean, how do you give personal attention to that many?
I'll tell you, I have been given a gift. I'm listening like crazy. I'm making notes. And also I have, I start by telling them the bad experience I had, so they know what it's like to be in a mean-spirited group. And the first thing I say is, after I did my very first workshop, the same mean-spirited stuff happened. So the second workshop that I ever gave, I said, I've only done this once and I failed miserably, but I learned something. Creativity requires safety. You will be safe here. I have one rule, and that is, when you finish reading, we will tell you what we loved. That's it. And that's what works. So it's not about editing. No one is allowed to say, oh, I heard something just like that. No one is allowed to say, I didn't like your ending. It's just positive stuff, and it isn't lies and phony stuff to be best friends with each other. It's just tell people what blew you away, and that's what happens. And because my goal is for people to leave totally juiced and thrilled and excited about going back home and just writing and writing and writing. And a lot of people take it multiple times, and they and their husbands or their best friends say, well, didn't you get it the first time? And they go, no, I did get it. That's why I'm going back. So it's sort of you're getting reminded of what a gift you have. Wow. So a lot of people take it many times, which is fine. It's, you know, well, nothing wrong with hearing how good you are over and over again.
In this book, Seven Secrets to the Perfect Personal Essay, you give feedback on usually just one essay per chapter, and the others you don't
That's
really.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
And
right.
But I noticed it was all what you loved.
Yeah. Well, because I'm not about publishing. My workshop isn't about product. It's about process.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So I don't, it's not about getting this thing fixed perfectly. Then you go to somebody, you can get an editor later. I just want, my goal is for you to just fall in love with your voice, get excited about the story that you have to tell, and feel confident enough to sit down and just get to it already.
Wow. Wow. And is that kind of your goal for this book too?
Yeah, exactly. I want people to say, wait a minute, you know, this is great. Maybe she would put my essay in there. Maybe I could have, you know, done that. And, you know, once I was in a bookstore many, 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 many years ago, and my husband found this poetry book called Tangled Vines, and I tiptoed over his shoulder and read, and it was a mother-daughter poetry book. And it was edited by a woman named Lynn Livshin. And I thought, wow, I would love to be in that book. I could write a thing about my mother. And so we went to the beach, and I sat and I wrote a gorgeous thing about my mother, and I mailed it to her thinking, well, what if she does another book? Well, nothing happened really. But then I wrote another letter saying, you know, how that book had impacted me. This is a wild story now that I think about it. I haven't told this in years. A friend of mine came over about 4 years later, and she was actually the girlfriend of my brother-in-law, and she was quite the little hippie, adorable. And she stops at my house. I'm in the garden with dirty hands, and she says, I bought this book for someone else, but I was driving by your house, and it was screaming, it's a Nancy book, it's a Nancy book, so I have to give it to you. So she hands me the book. My hands are dirty. And I said, oh, thank you, Jude. That's lovely. Read something. So she thumbs through the book. She goes to the last entry. It was a book on journals. So there were journal entries from different women. It was called Ariadne's Thread. And the last page she reads, and it's my letter to that editor. It wasn't signed Nancy Arony, but it was my husband and I were in a bookstore in Martha's Vineyard. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Honest to God, it was the
oh
coincidence
my gosh.
Was unbelievable. I know. So my goal is for people to read this and say, I could be in there.
Yeah.
You know, I could. So then sit down and write it.
So Nancy, why don't you read a little bit from Seven Secrets to the Perfect Personal Essay for us?
Okay. I'll start with where you thought you liked.
I wrote a lot about
thank you. I wrote a lot about grief because I think, you know, it's just a huge topic and everybody experiences it. So this is the end of that part. Choosing to use grief as a healer takes time and practice, and writing is a practice. And the thing is, you're not just healing yourself by writing your story. You're healing the reader, because somewhere out there, there is someone with a wound the exact same shape as your words. So give yourself and the world the gift of your essays. Keep writing, keep loving, keep being, because it's never too late to turn darkness into something close to dazzling light. Please, if you do anything with this book, use writing for the most important person in your story. And that, dear beloved one, is you. The next step. I have been listening to Deepak Chopra, and it's having a profound effect on my teaching and my own work on my own self. The present moment. There's something to it, more than something. One of the things Chopra says is that our traumas are not who we are. They are just things that happen to us. He says we are all fictional characters in a collective dreamscape. Well, that's certainly another way to look at it. I encourage you to write personal essays as a way of addressing your past struggles, the hurts, the slights, the slices to your perfect heart. This will empower you to return to your compassionate self, your true nature. And then, once the wounds have been written and have begun to heal, comes the freeing part. It's time to let go of that past and live in the perfection of the now. You'll know because you'll feel that the story you've been writing and rewriting is old, that maybe you've been loyal to your suffering, that it's time to let it go and move on. It may take decades. It may take writing the same prompt 47 times, like I did with Dinner at Our House Was. It may not happen right away because you're still processing, which is fine too. Personally, I'm understanding the present moment is all there is more than I ever have. Between Be Here Now by Ram Dass, my teacher since 1977, Eckhart Tolle's The Power of Now, and Thich Nhat Hanh saying the present is the only thing there is, I'm wondering why it has taken me so long to get this. I should say is taking me so long, because I'm still working at it, but it is so worth the work. So when you get to that place where there's no more past and the future is unknown and you've said bye-bye to the story that shaped you, what will you write about? Let's wait and see. Shall we wait together in the moment? I think the title of my next book will be You. With love, Nancy.
Thank you, Nancy. And that's Nancy Slonim Arony with Seven Secrets to the Perfect Personal Essay. Caroline, were there some particular essays in here that really spoke to you?
Oh, gosh. You know, I read them and then I go on and then I read them again. And I, you know,
Caroline, you must be my age.
She will be 90 in June.
Oh, mazel tov. That's beautiful. I'm going to be 84, so we're the same age. Except you beat me beautifully. Oh, I'm so happy. No wonder you're sitting in the chair. Stay there, darling.
Yeah, well, the only time that my body doesn't hurt is when I'm sitting down.
Oh, I know. Oh, it's just, you know, I keep saying.
If I'm on my feet, I'm hurting.
I'm sure you've got a million younger friends like I do. And I say to them, you know, if you break your leg, it gets better. If you have a cold, it gets better. But this aging thing only gets worse. It really does. I mean, thank God your mind is great. But the physical thing, it just, you can't undo arthritis. You know, you just can't.
No.
But look how much joy the fact that you're doing a show with your daughter. What a gift.
I mean, I know.
This is going to keep you young till you're 103. And then you can quit.
That's what I'm holding out
we
for.
We have met so many interesting people all these years. I mean, it's just amazing. It really is. It's so much fun.
Yeah. And of course, Caroline was on the radio long before we started doing this show too. She had a radio show on the local station, interviewed everyone who came through town. It was a daily talk show for years.
Great.
And you know, who was Ned Beatty, was some a Carol?
Oh yeah, the actor. Yeah.
Marsha Wallace, you know, different people who came through great. Town for different reasons, and of course all the lots of local people too. And so
where are you guys from?
I'm in Fairfield, Iowa, and Caroline's now down the road in Mount Pleasant, Iowa.
Oh, yeah. Cool. Wow. Yeah.
So one of the stations that the show goes on is KHOE, which is the university radio station for Maharishi International University, which is the Transcendental Meditation Movement. The other station that we're on is KICI in Iowa City, which, of course, Iowa City is a Center for Creative Writing.
You know, great. Iowa. Iowa Writers Workshop. Yep.
That's right. That's right.
Yep.
The penultimate of them all.
Yeah.
The granddaddy.
That's right. That's right. But it sounds like your workshops are pretty popular.
I'm doing great. I'm just so very blessed. Very grateful.
So if people are interested, do you still have openings for the ones this year?
Yes. Yes. Every single one. And my website is, can you believe that we now say my website is? My word. Caroline, I remember my mother at 92 said, website, schmebsite. What is this? .org, .schmorg? What's going on? And now it's our language. My website is chillmarkwritingworkshop.com. And Chillmark is C-H-I-L-M-A-R-K. Chillmark Writing Workshop. So on there are the dates of the workshops. And yes, there's room.
Is Chillmark a town or?
It's a town on the vineyard, yes.
Okay.
It's up Island.
Okay. Yep. How did you end up on the vineyard?
My husband said when we were maybe dating, do you want to go to Martha's Vineyard? Because he's from Boston and it's right off the coast of Boston.
Right.
And I said, no, I'm Jewish. I'm not going where there's a quota. He said, what are you talking about? And I said, no, I know all about Martha's Vineyard. There's a quota for Jews. He said, no, I don't know where you got that. So I was a little paranoid about being Jewish because I'd experienced a lot of anti-Semitism. And so he talked me into it, and we took our bikes, and we rode here all the way up to Chillmark from getting off the ferry, so about 15 miles uphill. And we got to the corner of Beetlebung Corner, it's called, and there was a field of daffodils. I never saw, like, probably the way you'd feel if you saw tulips in Amsterdam. Thousands of yellow, gorgeous, wafting in the breeze. And I just burst into tears and said, I have to be here. This place, it just was calling to me. So we bought a cabin when we were rich, and then when we lost all our money, we came here and lived year-round. I always say we lost everything and then we moved here and we found everything.
All right. I got to ask, how did you lose all your money?
We had a business. My husband, when we were dating, was a nuclear physicist at Pratt & Whitney, a big corporate place, and working on the fuel cell that sent the Apollo 13 to the moon. And I was teaching college English, and he was working in Lucite, in plexiglass. And he designed something, and it was gorgeous. And skip very quickly to end the story as he started making furniture. And we both quit our jobs and started a very small business, which grew tremendously. We ended up having 150 people working. We had a 64,000 square foot building, and we were having a ball. We were rich, not rich the way you're rich now, but, you know, we could buy anything. We could travel. We could buy cashmere sweaters. We could buy hardback books. You know what that's like, $29. and then the oil crisis happened. And Lucite is an oil-based product.
Oh.
So our sheet stock went zooming up. And everybody copied us and went to China and started, or to Taiwan and started copying his designs. And crack cocaine came into our neighborhood of the factory. And we lost a lot of beautiful human beings to this drug, which I'm still convinced that the CIA planted in the cities. But that's another story. So anyway, we had to lay people off quickly. Everybody was copying us. And then eventually we were down to 15 people. And we didn't go bankrupt, but we closed the business. And my husband walked around for about a half a year saying, I can't work for anybody now that I've been my own boss. And then he and his brother started inventing, and they invented beautiful stuff. So we're back. We're not where we were, but we live in a little cabin in the most beautiful island ever. So we're pretty grateful.
Oh,
and we don't owe anybody anything, which is the biggest gift.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. So have you ever written about that journey?
You know, interesting. I really, maybe bits and pieces, but I haven't written the whole story. It's woven into things, but maybe
so
I will.
You wrote a book about writing memoir. Mm-hmm. Have you written your memoir?
That's a good question. I wrote my memoir. I paid $7,000 for somebody I knew to help me to read it. He did nothing but semicolons and commas. I could not believe it. I kept saying to him, when are we going to get to the meat? You know, oh, it's going to be a bestseller. It's beautiful. We're done. I was like, whoa, I just gave you $7,000 to fix my, you know, a copy editor could have done that.
Yeah.
And I was very angry. He said, you sound very angry. I said, I am. And he said, well, if you want me to, you know, keep going. I said, no, don't touch it. And then I hired a friend who was a fabulous editor. She had been my first editor and became my friend. And I asked her to do it. And she said, no, she was working for CNN then. She was in Atlanta. She had no time. She said, I have no time. And I flew down to Atlanta. I don't know if you're going to beep this out. I got her stoned and I got her to say yes. It's legal now. So you can leave that in.
Right, right.
And she said yes. And she said, but it's going to take me forever. So she kept it for about a year. And I didn't care because she's such a good editor. I just needed continuity. I needed flow. I knew I had the stories, but I didn't know how to make them connect. After a year, she sent me the box back. And she said, I am so sorry. I just couldn't do it. So I never even opened the box. And I started all over again. And then I opened the box and I saw that she actually had done stuff. But it was too late. I had already started again. So I have a very good agent, a big deal woman. I love her. I sent it to her. She said, I love it. It's going to be a hard sell. I still don't know why I didn't say to her why.
Yeah.
And I got 17 rejections. And they all said, seven of them, it was almost like they copied each other. They said, thank you for sending me Nancy Sloan Amirani's beautiful memoir. I laughed. I cried. The story is so powerful. It was about my son, basically.
Yeah.
And then the last line was, somehow I can't see it on my list. So my reaction was, well, what's wrong with your list? You know?
If
you loved it so much. And then the other thing was, I really wanted it to come out when I was 80 and I was 79. So I thought I didn't take the rejection as terrible. I thought, okay, fine. I'm just going to, you know. And then somebody asked me to do a Zoom workshop with Mark Allen. I didn't know who he was, but it turned out he was the publisher of The Power of Now, Eckhart Tolle's book, which is a huge bestseller and one of my teachers. And I said, sure. So we started Zooming and I saw his face when I was funny. He was laughing. And in the chat, people were saying great things. And I thought, this is the guy. He's the one I want. This is the publisher. He does all the spiritual stuff. I want him. I don't care about Simon & Schuster. I don't care about anybody else. This is the guy. So I couldn't wait for it to end. And then I was going to wait a few days and not be so aggressive. And then I was going to send it to him. The last night of our workshop together was about 12 sessions. I tuned in late because I forgot he was from California. And someone must have said, well, what do you think of memoir? I tuned in and this is what I heard. Oh, I hate memoir. My mother did this and my father did that. And I was born in New Jersey. I couldn't sleep that night. I was like, oh my God, he hates memoir. And I was going to ask him. So I had a fitful night of sleep and I woke up in the morning and I went and I looked at his list. And his list was mostly, in fact, all of it was how to. So I said, okay, how to write a memoir. And so Memoir is Medicine has about seven of my chapters from my memoir that I snuck in.
Did he publish it?
Yeah.
Does he know this story?
Nope. But it's his editor, of course, that I worked with and his editor that bought this last one. So.
Wow.
So now he's going to know it.
Yeah. So, Caroline, do you have some more comments? Yes. Okay.
Well, no, I don't have any particular ones except that I just it's amazing to me that all these people who that you have published here they're all a little bit different because, well, it shouldn't be amazing because everybody's different.
Right.
So of course they're all different, but they're all the same in a way. They all want to be heard.
Yes, exactly. Yep. And they, you know, they were written from the prompts that I gave in the class. And I actually asked people to not edit. I said, please leave them raw because I want people to know this is what came out of you whole. And there were a couple of things my editor said, you know what, this is too confusing. I'm going to change it to this. And then they would change. She would change it and she'd read it to me and I would say, okay, that's fine. But most of them are exactly from, they either wrote them in class or they wrote them as the homework because I give homework. I don't call it homework. I give them a prompt to write every night. And I tell them it has to be, you can spend as many hours as you want on it, but it has to read 2.5 minutes. And that's one of the reasons when 24 people can manage because we're listening to 2 minute pieces.
Right, right. How many words is 2.5 minutes?
About 750, 800.
Okay, okay.
Yep.
And do you still use prompts for your own writing?
No, what happens to me is I'm either eavesdropping and I hear someone say something. My husband is my muse now. He's very terrified about the planet. And somebody gave us their house in France and we could go there for 3 months. And he won't go because he won't fly because of the CO2 in the airplane. When we first got engaged, I wanted to go to Bermuda and he sat down with a pen and pencil and a pen and paper and showed me how much CO2 the plane was going to put out from Boston to Bermuda. So we got a guy that has been worried about the planet from the minute I met him. And I have always honored that. And yet we're so different because I want the air conditioner on. He would, you know, he deigns to let me have it on. Lots of small car. Don't drive a big car. He looks at SUVs and has a heart attack. He's very, very, all his decisions are based on the planet. And he's very frustrated because most people are in denial about it. And now it's, you know, he's been talking about, you know, disasters. And now they're happening and he's going, yep. You know, like now what are people going to do? They're still going to fly to Paris for the weekend? And the answer is yes, they are. So I write a lot of he gives me a lot of facts and information. And, you know, anything that happens to me, we took our kid. We were on a plane. We took our kid snowboarding in Santa Fe. I had to beg my husband to do that, but it's the grandchild.
Oh,
you know, just spending the money and the time and the kid. So I wrote a piece about that. And, you know, whatever's happening triggers. I go swimming every day and I pretend that I'm racing the person next to me because I never got to be on a team. So that kind of stuff. I don't really need a prompt. I just take it from life.
What would be your top 3 tips for structuring a personal essay?
Well, structure is a scary word for me, but you really have to know what you learned. If you're just writing, and then it's a journal entry. So what was the transformation? I got to see that you thought one way and something happened that made you see it a whole different way. So there's that. The vulnerability to me, finding out that there's a mushmelon broken heart in you so that I can relate and say, oh, yeah, me too. I want to know we're the same, even though our details are different. And then I think you can start it, and it doesn't have to be chronological. So don't worry about trying to say, and then in 1972, this happened, and in 1978. Just tell the story as if you were talking to your best friend who didn't know you, who didn't know anything about you, and this is what happened. And you just start talking, and it will flow out of you. Just don't worry about structure, and don't try to sound like a writer. Sound like you. Use your language, your rhythms, and tell your story from your gut and your heart.
Wow.
Yeah, very good.
One of the other things that you do talk about in the book is the power of threes.
Yep. You just did three.
Yep.
I think there's an inherent power of three. And I think, you know, probably anybody that that knows about sound will say that, you know, your heartbeat, the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, pyramid power, Goldilocks and the Three Bears, jokes, boom, boom, punchline, three. It's just a natural rhythm. It doesn't mean that you can't have a list of seven. It doesn't mean that do a nice balance of two. They all work.
Yeah.
But there is something when someone does three. If you have four, throw one away. Read them out loud. That's another thing. That's I should have said that because that's one of my biggest things. Read your work out loud, and you will hear what works.
Yes. Yes.
And you will hear what doesn't work. See, you know, Caroline, because you're a writer too. And then when you read with four, and then eliminate one, and you read with three, I guarantee you're going to go, yeah, that worked better. It had a better punch.
Yeah. And there's also the intro, body, conclusion, kind of overall structure.
Yep. Yeah. Thank you. Yep. Thank you, Monica, for reading the book.
Yes, I did. And so did Caroline. So, and yes, hopefully
many,
so were
yes,
our listeners.
Many times.
But we are now out of time. We always close with a quote. So, Mom, what have you got for us today?
Well, I've got a quote of three. We all just want to be understood. We all just want to be loved. We all just want to be heard. And that was from the book.
Aww. Well, thank you, Nancy. We certainly enjoyed speaking with you today. And, man, maybe one of these days I'll make it to your workshop.
Oh, Monica, come.
I would love to.
Let's talk again. Thank you very much for this.
All right. And see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye, everybody.